Hey, it's Greg Brown. Grab your logbook, because it's time for another cockpit adventure from the flying carpet. I'm an aviation author, adventure columnist, photographer, former National Flight Instructor of the Year, and Barnes & Noble Arizona Author of the Month. The flying carpet is a four-place single-engine light airplane. In it, my wife Jean and I have long traveled the North American continent, searching behind clouds for the real America, and experiencing aerial adventures like today's all along the way. Learn more at my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com, where you can also see photos from most episodes. And I'd appreciate your feedback in my Flying Carpet Podcast Facebook group. As I record this, we're just 2 weeks away from the 2024 total solar eclipse that will be coming up through Mexico and crossing much of the Midwest and the eastern United States. Now, I suspect a lot of you are planning on flying to see this eclipse, and if you're not, you probably should be. But I want to mention a few words about it before I get rolling here. First of all, plenty of people have experienced a partial solar eclipse, and a few have experienced an annular solar eclipse. But if you have never seen a total solar eclipse, it's so much more exciting and so much more memorable that it's something you don't want to miss. In any case, by the time you listen to this, you might have already attended the 2024 eclipse. But today, I am going to tell you about two previous solar eclipses that I have been to, and I think you'll find them interesting and inspiring if you're getting ready to go, and I think you'll find them memorable if you've already been to one. So climb into my flying carpet, everyone, and buckle up your seatbelts in preparation for today's flight number 30, eclipse.
Clear prop.
It was gray November in Indiana when I opened the battered campus mail envelope. I anticipated a meeting announcement inside, or other bureaucratic blather. But instead, there was a note from Art Winfrey, biology professor and fellow member of the Purdue Staff Aero Club. My wife Jean and I had joined the group after moving up the road from Indianapolis to Lafayette. "What are you doing this coming February 1979? Asked Art. "There's a solar eclipse in Winnipeg, and I'd dearly love to enlist an instrument pilot for the trip." I admit to swelling with pride at the words instrument pilot, but frankly, I wasn't very interested in going when I first read the note. I'd seen partial eclipses before, and pursuing an eclipse to Canada in dead of winter seemed hardly worthwhile. But Art, being a sharp guy, I suspected there must be some good reasons behind his enthusiasm. "I'm skeptical," I wrote back, "but tell me more." This would be a rare total solar eclipse, I soon learned from articles he sent, and therefore unlike the partial eclipses I'd seen in the past. With the sun entirely blocked by the moon, no special filters or glasses would be required to view it. Although the eclipse would be partial over most of North America, totality would occur over a narrow 195-mile-wide band, arcing through the U.S. Northwest and Canada. Winnipeg, Manitoba, would be the closest place for us to observe it. Before long, Art convinced me to reserve the Cessna 210 for the trip, quote, "in case we decide to go," unquote. The clincher came when a Purdue astronomy professor volunteered to join us. "You're hesitating?" she asked, when I questioned her about the details. "There won't be another nearby total solar eclipse for decades." Then she tantalized me with talk of Bailey's beads, the diamond ring effect, and other mysterious eclipse phenomena. Soon I found myself touting the expedition to others, and before long we'd filled the airplane's 6 seats. Our original plan called for departing to Winnipeg the day before the eclipse. But 2 days before the celestial event, Art and I noted a major weather system approaching Indiana from the southwest. The potential for wintertime icing appeared significant and could very possibly force us to scrub the trip. Quickly, the two of us took to our telephones, begging, cajoling, and arm-twisting our passengers to drop everything for departure yet that afternoon. Fortunately, everyone was as motivated as we were, and within hours we were airborne toward Minneapolis for the night. Our strategy worked. Next morning, the threatening weather passed well south of us, and we sailed frigid blue skies northwestward from Minneapolis. I'd never flown northern Minnesota skies in wintertime before, and was surprised at how different the terrain appeared than what I was accustomed to just a few hundred miles away. The land was pancake flat here, and below us, treeless, fenced farm fields were frosted by snow into stark geometric relief. Adding both beauty and mystery to the scene was the absence of moving vehicles on the ground, or even signs of plowing. I wondered where the residents might be, imagining them gone away for winter, or perhaps provisioned for long stays barricaded at home before a cozy fire. Soon we crossed from Minnesota into North Dakota, and upon reaching Grand Forks, followed the Red River north into Manitoba. Winnipeg, when we arrived, was crowded with eclipse watchers. But to our surprise, almost every store and restaurant in the city was closed. Apparently, once-in-a-lifetime February tourists did not justify opening on a Sunday. I was also intrigued to see electrical outlets at every parking space. Given the severe winters, plug-in engine heaters are mandatory for restarting cars in cold weather here. After wandering freezing through town, we finally found shelter and entertainment at the city's planetarium eclipse show. The excitement of our little group was tempered, however, by the weather forecast. Clouds might obscure tomorrow's celestial event. Next morning, Winnipeg was indeed overcast. Panic set in as we and thousands of other eclipse enthusiasts contemplated coming all this way for nothing. TV meteorologists recommended points west and north for possible better viewing, encouraging auto travelers westward onto the Trans-Canada Highway to Brandon. To avoid the crowd, we decided to fly north to Gimli on the shores of Lake Winnipeg. Time was running out, however. The 147-minute eclipse was to begin at 8:36 a.m., with totality occurring mid-morning. If all else failed, we hoped for a clear view from the air above the overcast. With the weather so cold, we had to preheat the airplane's engine before starting. By the time we did that, obtained a takeoff clearance and topped the clouds, the show had already begun. Hurriedly, we scraped frost from the inside of our windows using credit cards. Then, guided by our onboard astronomer, we punched pinholes in index cards to project the still partial eclipse on scraps of paper. At this point, the skies were still bright enough that had no one informed us of the event taking place overhead, I doubt anyone would have noticed. We could see clearly on our pinhole projectors, however, that the sun had already been trimmed to a crescent by the moon's overlapping silhouette. Yet none of us could be sure whether the perception of slightly dimmed daylight outside our windows was real or imagined. Amazing the power of the sun, that even when largely obscured it should be so bright. Fortunately, Gimli was clear when we arrived. We landed to find the airport ramp peppered with observers, tripod-mounted telescopes, and cameras. Not knowing what to expect, we set up our own equipment, then watched on our pinhole projectors as the moon silhouette overtook the sun's orb. I think it was Art who discovered that binoculars turned backwards could project the show at a larger scale. Only in the closing seconds before totality did the daylight finally dim dramatically and unnaturally. Then, suddenly, this bright sunny morning turned black. In an instant, stars appeared, birds stopped singing, and temperatures plunged 20 degrees. The crowd gasped in a single note and then was silent. It was as if our chests had been crushed, and as near to the end of the world as I ever hoped to experience. Where bright blue had illuminated just a moment before, black night skies now dominated overhead, tinged only by unearthly purplish light ringing the distant horizon. Overhead, in place of the sun, licks of flame ringed a dark circle like snakes on the head of Medusa. With the moon now covering the sun's disk, we were observing solar flares normally invisible in daytime brightness. Millions of miles long, they revealed themselves as streamers of orange fire in a pale white halo. Anyone who doubts the force of the sun in powering our Earth need only hear what happens when it suddenly disappears. The silence was oppressive. We didn't see much of Bailey's beads, bits of sun glinting from between mountains at the edge of the moon. But while seeking them, I was startled by the sense of daylight racing up from behind us. Before I could comprehend that it was departure of the moon's shadow, light burst from one edge of the orb overhead. It was the diamond ring effect, when the sun first peaks again from behind the moon. Then, just as suddenly as it had left us, sunlight returned. Birds sang, and the sky turned blue. We were alive. Although it seemed like eternity, totality had lasted a mere 2 minutes. Only then did I realize how cold I'd been. Temperatures when we arrived that morning had hovered around 10 degrees Fahrenheit. During the eclipse, they dipped below zero. The thought prodded me to hurry my passengers along and start the airplane's engine. No preheat was available here, and the oil might congeal if allowed to get too cold. Quickly, we gathered our gear and navigated through the still-stunned crowd. The Cessna's engine sputtered to life, and while we waited, shivering for the airplane to warm up, I turned to Art and shook his hand. 11 hours in the air had proven a small investment for 2 minutes I'll remember for a lifetime. I applied power for takeoff, and as our passengers monitored the show's conclusion through their pinhole projectors, I set course southbound toward full-strength sunlight and home. Now, before I move on to the second total eclipse of my lifetime, I want to mention a couple things. Those of you who don't know about the Gimli glider should look it up. It's a pretty incredible story about an airliner that ran out of fuel over that same airport where we went for the eclipse, nowhere near the time we were there. But it's a famous instance and worth reading about. So look it up. Now I'm going to move on to that second eclipse that my wife Jean and I attended. "You're so vain," taunted my friend Tom Lippert from the old Carly Simon song. "You flew your Learjet to see the total eclipse of the sun." I didn't take him too seriously because he and his wife Laurel had just flown their own Skylane, Henry, from Truckee, California, to meet our flying carpet at Haley, Idaho, for the August 2017 celestial event. Our journey had been in the making for months. Originally, Jean and I had planned to fly from our now home in Arizona to Oregon for the eclipse. But increasingly, it appeared that the state's airports and roads would be horrendously crowded. So I phoned Laurel and Tom, who better knew the area, asking, "Hey, are you two flying to see the eclipse? And if so, where?" "Greg, that's 3 months away," Laurel chuckled. But upon learning that hotels and ramp parking at even the smallest airports were already filling up, she proposed we rendezvous at Sun Valley, Idaho, where friends would loan us their condo. For 38 years, Jean had endured stories about my 1979 flight to Canada for a midwinter total solar eclipse on a weekend she had to work. Here finally was my chance to share the experience with her. But would the event meet her expectations? And my memory of it? As media hype grew, however, so did our concerns. Would we be able to land? Would there be room to park the airplane? Would the weather cooperate? Could we depend on getting ground transportation? Should we bring groceries, assuming restaurants would be full and stores empty? Just a week before departure, questions arose about our ramp parking reservations at Haley, Idaho. Happily, they were resolved by the good folks at Atlantic Aviation. Then there was the route itself. Would we have difficulty traversing the high mountains across northern Arizona, Utah, and Idaho? And transitioning Salt Lake City's mountain-ringed Class Bravo airspace? Finally, departure day arrived. And what a start to our journey. Overflying the Grand Canyon through Zuni Point Corridor, then Vermilion Cliffs National Monument, and spectacular Bryce Canyon, any remaining concerns gradually washed away as we threaded green and voluptuous 10,000-foot peaks through south-central Utah, cooled by just enough light rain showers to wash the bugs from our windshield. Then Salt Lake Approach welcomed us across its scenic namesake lake. Our destination, Haley's Freedman Memorial Airport, lies in narrow mountainous Wood River Valley, open only to the south.
"What's the holdup?"
radioed a charter jet pilot holding south of Haley as we approached.
"Haley Airport is saturated with traffic and it's a one-way airport,"
answered the Salt Lake City Center controller.
"Inbound aircraft land on runway 31 and outbound flights depart on runway 13.
Therefore, we were surprised when the control tower directed us to
"fly the east side of the valley inbound for left downwind runway 13 and watch for a departing Learjet on the west side."
This proved to be a very narrow valley, so we found ourselves closely skimming ridges on downwind. Clearly, circling to land on runway 13 was a privilege limited to light aircraft like ours. The tower manager later told us that 90 to 95% of their traffic is one-way due to terrain considerations, particularly unusual for an air carrier airport. After landing, the good folks at Atlantic Aviation accommodated both our airplanes on the crowded ramp. Waiting unexpectedly to greet us along with Tom and Laurel was my friend Matt Rhodes, having flown from Oregon in his own Cessna 182, Foxy. We wandered Ketchum the next day and famed Sun Valley, the nation's first destination winter resort featuring the world's first chairlift. Ketchum lay on the edge of the total eclipse's path and would experience just 1 minute of totality. Dared we drive two-lane mountain roads northward to the center of totality to double our viewing time without getting gridlocked in traffic? Ultimately, we decided to take that risk, but were astonished to find the road nearly devoid of traffic. We set up roadside among other spectators at 8,700-foot Galena Summit, 30 miles north of Ketchum. There we experienced the eclipse from the side of a gorgeous mountain valley. A bit of forest fire smoke dimmed the stars, but otherwise we enjoyed clear skies and perfect viewing. The eclipse was awesome, Jean told her mom after we returned home. The temperature dropped 25 or 30 degrees. The sky dimmed, and we could see solar flares and the sun's corona and the diamond ring effect at the end. But words and pictures can't describe the experience of being there. One big surprise for us proved to be a surprising lack of crowds for the eclipse in southern Idaho. Afterward, leftover eclipse t-shirts were likely available for pennies on the dollar. What an amazing journey, Jean and I exclaimed repeatedly as we overflew Great Salt Lake homeward, threaded Utah's beautiful central mountains, and again ogled Bryce Canyon, Vermilion Cliffs, and the Grand Canyon. A radar outage extended from Salt Lake City all the way to the Grand Canyon, but our new familiarity with the surrounding mountains erased any concerns. To occupy ourselves over the long flight, Jean and I compiled excuses as to why Carly Simon's vanity line did not apply to us. Excuse to fly the gorgeous Intermountain West to a new-to-us state. Excuse to reconnect with dear friends. And excuse to sightsee some of the world's most spectacular landscapes from aloft. But no matter. Sure. We'd planned for 3 months and flown nearly 9 hours to experience 2 minutes of totality. But those moments we'll remember for a lifetime. What's more, the views beneath our wings were proving nearly as memorable as the eclipse itself. So you know what? If flying adventure means vanity, count us in. See lots of photos from this episode on the Eclipse podcast page at my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. Thanks for riding along on today's Flying Carpet adventure. Please help me continue this podcast by sharing your favorite Flying Carpet episodes on social media, posting reviews on your favorite podcast directories, and donating via my Greg Brown Flying Carpet website. Thanks in advance for your support. You can find photos from most episodes at my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, please check out my book of aviation adventure stories, Flying Carpet, The Soul of an Airplane, for which I was named Barnes & Noble Arizona Author of the Month. Learn about that and my other aviation books at gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. Also at gregbrownflyingcarpet.com, you'll find my Views from the Flying Carpet aerial photography, available in fine art metal prints and pilot achievement plaques. Oh, and I'd appreciate hearing your feedback in my Flying Carpet podcast Facebook group. Follow my social media sites, most of which can be found by searching Greg Brown Flying Carpet, and consider joining my student pilot pep talk group on Facebook. Thanks again for joining me on today's Flying Carpet Cockpit Adventure. Music by Hannes Brown. See you next time.